So I'm going to talk about the ordination process. In the planning, Padmavacha suggested that I call my talk How to Get Ordained. And talk about that. By the way, I mean, I talk what I want to talk about. It's not that Padmavacha tells me what I should do, so make that sure. So I'm going to talk about the ordination process. So I'm going to talk about main principles, and I try to go into very practical things as well, things you can do to get ordained. In a sense, it's very simple. I mean, just sort of keep practicing and make sure you're in contact with order members. I mean, do all the things Padmavacha talked about yesterday, and that's it. In a way, sort of, what I mean is there's nothing sort of... Thank you. What the ordination process is just a deepening of our practice, which we do anyway. Yeah. But there are certain specific areas or certain specific things to do with being in the ordination process, and especially with your situation as men who have asked for ordination, which I want to sort of bring out and apply to the ordination process and to one's practice. So what have you done when you have asked for ordination? I don't know if you're aware of that, but what you've actually done is you expressed the commitment to basically strive towards enlightenment. Yeah. You expressed the commitment of to fully go for refuge with the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, making these the most important things in your life, and you're basing every decision in your life on that. Yeah. And you made the commitment that you're going to strive for enlightenment, and that you do that for the benefit of all beings. I think it's quite important to remember that, to keep that in mind, what we're actually doing when we ask for ordination. It's quite a tremendous thing to do. I think usually one doesn't know what one is doing when one asks for ordination. I think I didn't. Yeah. Usually one doesn't know really what one is doing, what you let yourself in for. I think it has been said in the past, I think it was sort of one of those sayings around in the order, that when you teach people meditation, you sort of put a time bomb into their lives. You don't know when it's going to explode at some point. With asking for ordination, it's more like that. Yeah? You sort of put something into your lives with your ordination request, and you've got no idea where it's going to lead you. It's really important to be aware of that. Yeah, you don't know what you're going to do in 5 or 10 years' time. Sorry?
I did say that.
Yeah, so you may have an idea about your life. It's all mapped out, and then the ordination comes into it, and it's all sort of planned until your retirement and death. But it's not going to be like that. You don't know where you're going to be in 5 or 10 years' time, and you don't know what you're going to do. Yeah, you don't know what your lifestyle will be. I think it's really useful or important to keep that in mind. Yeah. You may, in 5 years' time, you may do something which you haven't thought about yet. And it's important to keep, to be aware of that. I mean, I know some of us, and you have changed our lives already. Yeah, giving up careers to work at Windhorse, great thing to do. Yeah, can recommend that, and so on. So, it's quite a big decision. Asking for ordination is a very big decision. And you open yourself to the influence of the Dharma, the Buddha, and the Sangha, the order. And we take that very seriously. Ideally, what we do as order members, we relate to you on that basis. Yeah. In asking for ordination, you say, well, I'm going to make Buddhism as is practiced in the Theravada Buddhist order, as taught by Sangharakshita, the center of my life. And then we relate to you on that basis. That's what the order should do or does. So we take it very seriously. To look at it in a certain formula which Bhante introduced, which I think is very useful and helpful, you're probably aware of that, the teaching of levels of going for refuge. If you're not aware of it, then learn it. I think it's really important. different levels of going for refuge, of its practice. And just to mention sort of the ones more important for us. Okay, there's the what he called the ethnic one or social one, just you were born into a Buddhist country or just a social event Buddhism. Then there's a provisional one. You try it out. Yeah, it's sort of, you don't really fully commit to Buddhism, but you sort of try it out. It corresponds roughly to the mitra, being a mitra, and you ask to become a mitra. Yeah, so you try it out. You don't make a full commitment, but you try it. In ordination, in asking for ordination, in ordination, you want to move towards effective going for refuge. And you, I think it's useful to take the word effective literally. Yeah? It has an effect on your life. Yeah? So in moving towards effective going for refuge, you allow the Dharma and the three jewels to have a real effect on your life. A way to look at that is what you've done before ordination, before asking for ordination, you try to integrate Buddhism into your life. Yeah? We all try to integrate Buddhism into our lives, sort of thing. Yeah? Books are written about that, how to integrate Buddhism into your life. With ordination, it turns around. You could try to integrate your life into the Dharma, into Buddhism. The Buddhism is big. Buddhism is bigger than your life. Yeah? You don't try, how can I fit a bit more meditation into my life, but how can I change my life so I can meditate more? You don't try to sort of organize the Sangha somehow into your schedule. You look at, how do I schedule my life so that I can have more contact with the Sangha? Yeah? So the values are reversed in asking for ordination. It's quite a big thing, actually. You're probably aware of that from the earliest times of this particular ordination process, so late 80s, at some point there came the so-called six guidelines in discussing ordination requests. I think they're quite widely known now. And the first two ones were always a bit of a puzzle for many of us order members. Mm-hmm. Is he sincerely going for refuge? One. Second, is he effectively going for refuge? And I must admit, I just didn't quite know what the difference was. And it was Chittapala, quite shortly after my ordination, explaining it. And this sort of makes sense. Sincerity is to do with your mind. Effectiveness is what you actually do, your actions, your external actions. So I suspect we're all very sincere, but that's a mental thing. It's good to be sincere, yeah, we all are sincere. I mean, I can't think of anybody I know in the ordination process who isn't sincere. But effective means, what are you actually doing? Yeah, how do you organize your life? So that's what we look at in our training for ordination. How do we organize our lives? And in asking for ordination, you expressed that you want to be part of the order, and the order is defined as the disciples of Sangrachita and their disciples. Yeah. Yeah, so part of training for being an order member is becoming more and more aware of Sangrachita as our teacher. And you take on his teachings and take them very seriously. That's basically what we practice and what we base our lives on. Yeah, Sangrachita's exposition of the Dharma and his vision of the order. I mean, he created the order, sort of obviously. So to understand what it means to be an order member, you have to understand his thinking. Yeah. Yeah, so we also become disciples of Sangrachita, or disciples of his disciples. So I want to look at this, the ordination process, the state of being a mitra in the ordination process, from the point of view of the three jewels, the three refuges, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and try to look at sort of how do they really apply to our lives, and especially how do they apply to the life of somebody in the ordination process. And I'm going to reverse the traditional order. So I talk about Sangha, Dharma, and Buddha. For the sake of this talk, I found it easier to organize it, my thoughts that way. So I'm going to start with the Sangha and end with the Buddha. And then afterwards, I'm going to say a few more very practical things about certain institutions in the order and ordination process. And then I'm going to say a bit about what happens after ordination. So taste what you can expect or may expect. So the Sangha refuge. I couldn't find the quote, so I don't quite know where it is, but Bhante says somewhere, what we do when we deepen our going for refuge, and especially when we get or ask for ordination, we move from being a sort of general Buddhist more to being a sort of specific Buddhist in a specific tradition. Yeah. There is no such thing as a general going for refuge in the abstract. It can only be to concrete people and concrete practices. Yeah. So going for refuge to the Sangha means us. Yeah. The people you actually have around you. So in going for refuge to the Sangha, it's not just that you sort of go for, sort of, okay, ultimately only the Arahants are the real refuge, we know that. But practically speaking, it's the order members who know you and whom you get to know. Because, I think it's quite important, you have not asked to be, you don't want to become an ordained Buddhist, you want to become a member of the order. It's not that after ordination you're an ordained Buddhist, and then you can walk around as an ordained Buddhist and teach people because you're an ordained Buddhist. It's more you're a member of an order. Yeah? There's other people involved. Yes, you have asked to join this particular order, these particular people. More specific, you have actually asked to join the chapter of your home center. Because there are always exceptions. But actually what it means is at ordination, you're going to join a chapter at your center. Yeah. So it's very specific people. Yeah, you all know them. They are your Sangha, with all their imperfections, but they're the people in your life. So you need to be in contact with them. A few years ago, we had a Going for Refuge in Germany, and we talked about what it means to prepare for ordination. It was all sort of difficult, and because our order doesn't rely on rules, it's more principles, and so on. Those are a bit sort of loose. And Lalit Trotner made a very good point. He said, well, in a sense, it's quite easy. The main point is, make sure order members get to know you. It's very practical. Yeah? So the first point about this is, make sure you're in contact with order members. Because you want to join the order, so they need to know you, and you need to know them. Yeah? So put yourself into a situation where you can get to know each other. Order members are not clairvoyant. We don't know, we can't say anything about the depth of your going for refuge if you don't show it. If you live somewhere in isolation, we don't notice the depth of your going for refuge. I would even go a step further. If you don't do anything about it, it may not be very deep. Yeah? It must express itself in a practical thing, in practical actions. Yeah? Yeah, so very simple. I mean, just a question of organizing one's life. Make sure order members get to know you and you get to know order members. Yeah. And that should inform decisions you make about your life. Yeah, if you want to move somewhere, do you know, move somewhere where there's order members or not? That decision is influenced by our going for refuge to the order, to the Sangha. Yeah. That shows in a way where our values are. Yeah, so make sure order members can get to know you. It's quite simple. I said that order members aren't perfect, yes. There will be difficulties, and there will be order members whom you find disappointing. And just one important point. If you want an ideal Buddhist movement, get out. This is the wrong place for you. Sorry. Yeah, I mean, if you look for an ideal Buddhist movement, an ideal spiritual community, then this is the wrong place. I don't think you'll find one. Yeah? But it's certainly not this one. So, I mean, become aware of that. Yeah? There's a sense of growing up in a way. And one can, as a mitra, I used to do that, you can get this sort of, you come together amongst mitras and complain about order members. I mean, one does this as a mitra, yeah? In 10 years' time, you're going to be an order member, and some mitras will complain about you. I mean, yeah, so this may happen. Be aware of that if you're not completely satisfied with the order members at your center. Yeah. At some point, people will sort of moan about you. You don't think you're lazy and selfish and don't care about people and so on. Yeah, but there will be difficulties. I mean, the order is comprised a lot of fully enlightened bodhisattvas. You know, just, it's just how we are. Yeah. So don't expect perfection from order members. I'm going to come back to, so under the heading of Sangha come Kalyanamitras and preceptors, but I want to talk about them later when I talk about more practical things here, how to get Kalyanamitras, how to get public and private preceptors. We'll come back to later. But this is the next steps in your engagement with the order is deepening your friendships with order members, that there will be a Kalyanamitra relationship and a preceptor relationship. Okay, also under the heading of Sangha, I could put it anywhere really, but I put it there. The question of lifestyle. Yeah? Because as I said, to get or to join the order, you must make sure that you sort of you spend time with order members. And there are certain lifestyles which makes it easier than others, which means living in a community, for example. Yeah? So there's something to look at, yeah? How do you live? With whom? I did some sort of statistics lately, because I've got this, I've got the database where I put everything about people on it, and all the facts about people. And I did some research on how long it takes to get ordained, and comparing it how long it took years ago. And, sort of. And it's quite interesting. It takes long, on average, it takes longer now to get ordained than, say, 10, 20 years ago. Yeah. So, of course, one could come to the conclusion it's the evil ordination team making everything hard for people, and it's the order being too institutionalized, having too many rules. Yeah. That's one conclusion. But then you actually look at the people involved. And there are still, every year, there are quite a few people who get ordained after a very short time. Every year. Yeah. And then you look who they are, and you look how they live. And there's a pattern there. Yeah. They live a full, they usually, I mean, it's a generalization, there are exceptions. Yeah? But on the whole, there are people who live sort of in a full, more or less full-time Triratna context. So the fact that sort of people need longer to get ordained, I don't think it's to do with sort of the ordination team being evil or sort of mean with ordination, hold it back and sort of make it difficult. You don't want to make it difficult for people, but it's more to do with lifestyle. Yeah? In one of the most important books, Ten Pillars of Buddhism, read it at least once every year. Actually, I mean this. It's one of the most important books we have. Yeah. Ten Pillars of Buddhism. We've got a retreat on that. And there's a whole discussion on the 10 precepts collectively. And bit as an aside, this first half is a brilliant introduction into what the order is. It's actually about what is the order. The 10 precepts collectively. It's the bit which gets a bit neglected because we find the precepts more interesting, yeah, what we should and shouldn't do. But the first half is actually really interesting. And in that, he talks about the 10 precepts and lifestyle. He talks about this aphorism, commitment, primary, lifestyle, secondary. And he says, lifestyle does not represent some ethically neutral way of life, which can be combined without modification with the pursuit of enlightenment. For this reason, one's lifestyle is something that is open to criticism, so that one cannot, as a Buddhist, rebut criticism of such things as one's particular attitudes, beliefs, habits, or behavior with the indignant rejoinder, "Oh, that's my lifestyle." As though this at once placed the matter not only beyond criticism, but beyond discussion. Yeah. So again, in asking for ordination, you opened your lifestyle to criticism. Yeah. Just important to remember that. There's a few other things about the Sangha Refuge. As an order member, I said you're going to join a chapter, and Pama Vajra talked yesterday about gathering in large numbers, order weekends, conventions, and so on. And in the ordination process, there are this sort of, you train for that. So we put on kula gatherings, yeah, gatherings for men who've asked for ordination. They're a sort of precursor of order weekends, yeah, so you train to be on them. And one can't find them difficult, but I think one should come anyway. I know many people find large gatherings difficult. I mean, I bet temperament, I find them difficult. But I think we can learn to enjoy them and learn to survive them at least. Yeah. The main point to remember is people are not your enemies. Yeah, it's sort of. So you cooler gatherings, and as a sort of precursor or yeah training for the order chapter, we've got, well, they are going for refuge groups, and probably most of you know about them, or most of you are in one, but they are not organized by the order. Yes, it's not as order members sort of organize mitras around and put them into groups. It's sort of the mitras themselves. It's you sort of organize yourselves. But it's a good way of training for being an order member, being in a chapter, being in a going for refuge group. Okay, so there's a few things on the Dharma, on the Sangha refuge. Yeah, so it all comes down to make sure you're in contact with people. And it's not just in terms of, I mean, the relationship in the order, it's not some sort of, it's nothing professional. You can look at it in other ways. You want to develop your friendships with order members, and friendship means you actually spend time with each other. Yeah? And you enjoy each other's company. In the case of dysentery, it's a very important talk, but it talked about, well, one of the main aspects of friendship is you enjoy the other person. So it's not just you're sort of good for your friend if you're nasty to him and challenge yourself. It's actually about enjoyment. So you can learn to enjoy the company of your fellow Buddhists. Okay, so moving on to the Dharma refuge. And again, we move from a sort of the Dharma in general, which is a lot of teachings, to something specific. Yeah. So to go for refuge to the Dharma in the context of our order means specific teachings and specific practices, which come from Sangharakshita. Yeah, the main ones come from Sangharakshita. And we have to understand them. Yeah, we have to understand Bhante's thinking, and we have to understand the practices he teaches. I'm going to borrow a term from Surata. We have to become Sangharakshita experts. You become a Sangharakshita expert. Which can mean reading his books. I said read the 10 pillars at least once a year. 2 or 3 times is better. Yeah. The survey, very important text, and a few others. But then mainly you study with order members. I think you probably get more from just making sure you're in a study group with order members. So let's look at the Dharma, specific Dharma refuge, in terms of the threefold path: ethics, meditation, wisdom. So ethics means the 10 precepts, and I mentioned the 10 pillars. So what we need to do to prepare for ordination is to really understand Bhante's teaching of the precepts. So it's not only a matter of understanding what's skillful and what's unskillful. I mean, that's important to know what's ethical and what's unethical, yeah, what to do. But equally important, maybe more important, understand Bhante's thinking about the precepts in general, the principles of ethics. Yeah. That they're not rules but training principles, and so on. Another of Bhante's important teaching about ethics is the importance of imagination in ethics. He talks about the first precepts to a large extent in terms of the imagination. Yeah. The fact that you can imagine what it's like to be another human being is the basis for ethics. Yeah, so our training in ethics means to really understand Bhante's exposition of the Ten Precepts and of his understanding of ethics. Meditation, mindfulness of breathing and metta-bhavana. Do the practices. Quite straightforward, really. Sort of just practice them. And make sure you know what you're doing when you meditate. It's a common sense, really, but they are the basis for all practices. Yeah? Mindfulness of breathing, metta-bhavana, just sitting. Do retreats, do meditation retreats. You can really learn them. Ask yourself, do you have trust in the practices? Or do you rather have trust in the latest book by an American author? They're often American authors. I mean, nothing against Americans, just happen to be American. Do you more? It's this question of sort of the grass is greener on the other side. Yeah, sort of this us practicing the same old metta bhavana, mindfulness of breathing, struggling along. Then you see some book cover where the author offers the method to save your meditation. I mean, yeah, you can look at those things, but actually on the whole, the urge to look at those things may come from a lack of faith in our own practices. So do you have trust in our practices? Do you know how to work with your mind? That's what meditation is about, working on one's mind. Yeah. Do you take responsibility for your mental states? Do you know what to do about them? This is the area of meditation. Go on retreats. At least for 2 weeks. One retreat means 2 week long, I mean not 2 week retreats, but aim for a 2 week retreat. I think that's so practical. I mean, the longer the better. Yeah. But my impression is, or my experience with retreats is sort of a short one, like a week or 9 days, is sort of just a week. You enter it and you see the end already. Sort of, you know it's going to be over soon. 2 weeks feels more like, well, you have to settle down into it. Yeah. So make sure you go on retreats, meditation retreats. Especially meditation retreats when you can learn about the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana or the brahma viharas. And do a solitary. It's also quite important. Spend time on your own. Make sure you do solitaries. Okay, so meditation in our system. Wisdom means understanding Sangharakshita's exposition of the Dharma as laid out in the survey. I mean, I would recommend two texts, The Survey of Buddhism and the paper written by Subhuti, Revering and Relying Upon the Dharma. And personally, I find those the two most helpful ones. And you need to study the survey. I mean, reading it is a good thing, but actually you need to study it in a study group. At least, probably 10 times. Yeah, I mean, I've done it a few times, and each time I get something new out of it. So, it's part of the ordination process to do the Transcendental Principle Retrieval. You study the first chapter of the survey. But it's a very important text. So it's about understanding Bhante's exposition of the Dharma. So concretely, that means understanding the centrality of going for refuge. Of going for refuge and Paticchasamutpada, conditioned co-production, yeah? Understanding Bhante's view, Bhante's understanding that Paticchasamutpada, conditioned co-production, is the central teaching of Buddhism, and all other teachings should come out of that. All later teachings are just different ways of talking about conditioned co-production. If they don't do that, they're not really Buddhism. That's something to discuss. So understand, and if you're fascinated by emptiness and shunyata, check it against conditioned co-production. Because that what it should be in harmony with. So really understand what's meant by that. So really familiarize yourself with Bhante's exposition of the Dharma. Become a Sangharakshita expert. also under this heading, I put the Bodhisattva idea, because one of Bhante's teachings is, as I said, the centrality of going for refuge, which means going for. It's different from traditional Buddhist view. I think, in a sense, we're very different from other more traditional Buddhist groups. Going for refuge is a central act in Buddhism. We know all that, although I don't think we really understood it. The central act in Buddhism, and everything should come out of that. So specifically, the Bodhisattva ideal is the altruistic dimension of going for refuge. In other words, you can't have going for refuge without the Bodhisattva idea. Yeah. So understand that there's an altruistic dimension to going for refuge. We practice for the benefit of all beings. Yeah, so make sure you study in a study group, study the Dharma, go on study retreats. Okay, so much for the Dharma. There's probably more to say about that, but this gives you a few ideas. Now the Buddha, which I found the most difficult to talk about, because I don't understand what the Buddha is. So what does it mean to go for refuge to the Buddha? It means going for refuge to the Buddha as the Buddha. Self-evident, really. Yeah. You don't go for refuge to the Buddha as a philosopher, thinker, and so on, or therapist. Yeah. The Buddha was not some ancient Sigmund Freud. He was not an ancient Socrates or Schopenhauer, and he was not an ancient Sigmund Freud. He's not an ancient psychiatrist. He's not an ancient philosopher. Yeah, not an ancient scientist. Yeah, he's not a sort of early Indian Einstein or Heisenberg. Yeah, it's nothing to do with all that. Yeah, it's something far beyond it. And the best thing is, you don't understand who the Buddha is. Just don't understand the Buddha. He is a category on his own. Yeah, I don't think I need to quote this, but Bhante talks about this in the survey. Yeah? As a Buddhist, we don't go for refuge to the Buddha, the rationalist, the thinker, the philosopher, but to the Buddha as the Buddha, yes, somebody we don't understand. Yeah, the Buddha is beyond our understanding. The nature of the Buddha is beyond our understanding. Yeah. And any idea we have about him is probably wrong. Buddhism is a religion. Yeah, it has a transcendental element. Don't forget that, yeah? So the Buddha is higher, is different from us. Yeah. And we don't really understand what he's like. We don't really understand the Buddha by seeing him as part of the development of Indian thought. We don't really understand who he is. Yeah. Which also means we don't really understand the Dharma if we see it as part of the development of Indian philosophy and thought. Yes, it is Indian, yeah, yeah. But there's something not from this world in it. Yeah, there's something not from this, the different world. The Buddha doesn't come from a different country, he comes from a different dimension. So maybe the only or safest way to understand the Buddha is through devotion and prayer and faith. Yeah, I think our sort of rational mind can't understand the Buddha. And if you want to get closer to the Buddha, you sort of intellectually you sort of get lost. Yeah? Probably in our own very interesting thoughts. But maybe the way to approach the Buddha is devotion and faith. Yeah? And you can just, it's probably safer to pray to the Buddha rather than having good ideas about him. So is that our understanding of the Buddha? That's what we have to ask ourselves. Do we relate to the Buddha in this way? If not, does that mean we go for refuge to the Buddha as the Buddha? Or do we go for refuge to the Buddha as an idea of something we like? Yeah? So many of us are rational people, so we like to think of the Buddha as an early Schopenhauer or Kant or Socrates. Yeah? Or we're fascinated by cosmology and science, so we think of the Buddha as an early Einstein or Heisenberg. Well, no, he was the Buddha. Yeah? He wasn't interested in how the universe came about and all that. So it's a completely different kind of being. So we have to open ourselves to that. Yeah? So we can ask ourselves, is the Buddha a living presence in our life? Do we think about the Buddha? And there are ways of helping us to do it. You can read the Pali Canon, read the Buddhist scriptures. Good way of approaching the Buddha. And that's a personal thing. The way I like to read the Pali Canon at the moment is probably my intellectual laziness. But I tend not to read it so much in terms of looking for interesting teachings. I read it more in terms of to see somebody living their life. There's a lot of things happening in the Pali Canon. It's actually very funny in a way, very entertaining, very interesting and engaging. Yeah? So I personally don't tend to study sutras in terms of taking notes and writing down the lists and things. Too lazy to do that. So I read it more like a novel. It's actually good to just read the Pali Canon like you read a novel or a collection of short stories. Yeah? Read through the Majjhima Nikaya, middle length thing, as a collection of short stories. I can really recommend that. So read the Pali Canon. And there's the going for refuge and prostration practice, which we do, yeah, which puts us in contact with the Buddha. Sorry? I haven't read that. So read Vishwapani's book. Sorry. I haven't read it. I don't know. It's probably very good. No, the other one everybody should have is Nyanamoli, The Life of the Buddha. And the thing should have. I mean it. Buy it. It's very cheap nowadays anyway. So. But it's actually really important to have that, a really good book. Yeah, so familiarize yourself with the Buddha. And don't make the Buddha into something you like or you feel comfortable with. Keep the mystery open. Yeah, keep being open to the mystery and engage with the Buddha with faith and devotion. Okay, so a few bits on the Buddha refuge. I mean, just on that, yeah, one more thought. Again, I haven't checked the quote, but there's little sort of different lists or texts about how to assess somebody's readiness for ordination. And yeah, are they in contact with order members? Do they meditate? But there's also one, is there a touch of the transcendental in the person? Yeah. So that's another thing. And for me, you can rephrase that. Is the Buddha, as the Buddha, a living presence in their lives? Yeah. Are you in contact with that dimension? Okay, so these were the three jewels in terms of the ordination process. I'm going to say a few more sort of technical bits, but something else before, I think I should have said it earlier. So I talked about effective going for refuge and the levels of going for refuge. I think it's quite an important point, actually. We've got provisional going for refuge. We try it out. Yeah? Try to make sure Buddhism is part of our lives. We've got effective going for refuge. We strive toward making the Buddhism the center of our lives. But that's not enough. We can always lose that. We can fall back. We do fall back. Yeah? Only with what Bhante is calling real going for refuge, it's real. We just traditionally called stream entry. So don't assume you're safe, spiritually speaking. We should never assume we're safe. Yeah. It's not that, okay, now we think we sort of have been on a few retreats, been ordained a few years, I won't lose that. We can lose it all, easily. Yeah. If life gets too pleasurable, the right or wrong person comes around, out goes the Dharma. Only as the right person or the wrong person come along. So you're not safe. Don't rely on what you've got, virtually speaking. Yeah? It can get lost. And part of effective going for refuge is, or part of readiness for ordination is being aware of that and doing something about it. So to be ready for ordination does not mean you have to be a great spiritual being. Yeah? It does not mean you have to be able to practice under all circumstances. Yeah? It's quite the opposite. It actually means being quite humble. Yeah. Funnily enough, readiness for ordination means to really be aware that alone you are lost, spiritually speaking. And to really be aware and know that you need supportive conditions. And to do something about that. Yeah. So it's not about being a wonderful person who can practice everywhere. I mean, I'm quite slightly suspicious about this claim. It's more about you actually realize how weak you are and how utterly dependent on condition your practice is. And then you do something about that. You put yourself into supportive conditions. And in a sense, that's effective going for refuge. Yeah? It's making sure you know about the right conditions, you know about the importance of conditions, and you put yourself into them. Sort of comes back to the question of lifestyle in a way, yeah? Okay, so a few more kind of technical points, or so-called institutional points. I think I hinted at some of them. But it's basically Kalina, Mitras, and Preceptors. Just a few more things to do about them. And according to the rules, well, you need a preceptor to get ordained. You don't actually need Kalina, Mitras to get ordained. So don't get into panic about it if you don't have Kalina, Mitras. Okay. But with Kalina Mitras means you have two order members who are experienced enough in the order and who have the trust of the order that they can do that, and you can ask them to be your spiritual friends, your Kalina Mitras. And then if everybody involved in the discussion is happy, so this is discussed in the order chapter and a private preceptor has to be happy with it, then the ceremony can be carried out. And in doing that, you basically commit yourself to a friendship which is not going to end. It's the rest of your life. So think carefully. And based on going for refuge. Yeah. And these are people you are hopefully more or less in daily contact with. Yeah, so you can ask two order members with a certain number of years standing, 5 years, and ask them to be your Kalina Mitras. It's not something you have to take, don't do it just because you think you need them to get ordained. It's more, you're in contact with order members, you develop your friendships with order members, and out of that network of friendships, there will be two emerging who could be your Kalina Mitras, and you can ask them. And you have to ask, you have to make the take the initiative. Similar with a private preceptor, so you do need a private preceptor to get ordained, and you have to ask. You have to find one. Yeah. At the moment, the way it's working, we don't provide them. So you can just ask any order member. Yeah. I think any order member of at least 10 years standing in the order to be your private preceptor. And just the way it functions is, if he hasn't ordained anyone yet, he has to be accepted by the order as a private preceptor. So then the whole process starts. The consultation process, which is published in Shabda, then everybody who has a view on the person can say so, and all sorts of feedback, and if you deal with that somehow and sort it all out. But it's a very thorough process, which means if you have a preceptor and they're accepted, you can be assured that the order trusts them. It's really important, because if order members don't trust your preceptor, they wouldn't trust your ordination. It's all based on the trust. Just on how to choose a preceptor, think practically in a way. I mean, don't get too romantic about it. Don't get romantic at all about it. Yeah. It's not some sort of spiritual marriage made in heaven. It's not sort of the right person. It's not that there's somehow out in the universe there's the right preceptor for you, and all you have to do is find him. And if you don't find him, catastrophe. It's not like that. In a sense, anyone could do it, any preceptor, in a certain sense. Yeah. But they have to be available. Yeah, so if you have to be able to be in contact with them. And you have to, well, it has to be mutual respect. Yeah, I mean, do you trust, I mean, the question is, do you trust the person to believe when they say you're ready for ordination? Or do you sort of freak out or get a shock? Yeah. Do you actually, that's the main trust you're looking for. Do you respect the person and have trust in the person? So you ask for a private preceptor. And it's the same with calamitous. Don't get too stressed out about it. Yeah, don't get too panicky about it. If you've just asked for ordination, don't worry about a preceptor. Just forget about the issue. Yeah. You can start thinking about getting a preceptor maybe a few years into the ordination process, if things become more serious. And you start thinking about it. But don't get worried to begin with. Yeah. I think it's quite important. I mean, this talk could be told how to get ordained, but I'm not giving you a list of things to tick off. And getting a preceptor is not a thing to tick off and then you've done. It's more you're in contact with order members, and out of that contact, a preceptor relationship emerges. Yeah. I mean, there's this old saying. I mean, I must admit, I don't like these sayings. So, when the disciple is ready, the teacher will arrive. It's so cheesy. And, you know, I don't. It's one of those sayings that sound good, but are a bit, feel good sayings sort of thing. I'd like to rephrase that. You develop your friendships in the order. And as you develop your friendships in the order, when the conditions are right, a preceptor relationship will emerge. It's not that when you are ready, the preceptor will come around the corner and sort of, I ordain you. It's more, if the conditions are right, which means you've got to know each other, there's mutual respect, then this will more or less naturally emerge. Yeah, so it's a private preceptor. The public preceptor, you don't have to worry about at all. Could be a relief. It's been provided, the public priesthood is being sort of provided by the, well, in, practically speaking, by the ordination team. So it's actually Satyaraj and the three in the call under the green tara, so Suvata, Sadaloka, Pramavacha. It's very likely that one of those four is going to be your public preceptor, unless you're sort of from Scotland where Damarati is doing the ordination. So it's sort of more. Who's available? It's more a question of who's available. Yeah. And with your public preceptor, the relationship is not that close. I mean, you know each other, but not on sort of day-to-day practice level. Yeah, it's not that such a close relationship. Yeah, so ideally, you get the full set. You've got two kalanamitras, a private preceptor, and a public preceptor, all four. Yeah. And so don't chase after this. And the nature of the relationship is sort of the higher up, so-called higher up you go, the less contact you have, but the more spiritually significant it gets. Yeah. So with your kalanamitras, there's lots of contact, hopefully, daily contact if you can. Yeah. And it is a spiritually significant friendship. Yeah, it is important. No doubt about that. With a private preceptor, there may be less contact, but it's very significant because he's ordaining you. He gives you your name. Yeah. With a public preceptor, there's even less contact, but it's much more significant because he's welcoming you into the order. You can go a step further. With Bhante, it's even more significant because it's the base of everything we do, but you have hardly any contact with him. With the Buddha, it's much more significant, but you don't see him at all physically. Yeah, you see what's getting at. So it's more and more significant, but there's less and less contact. Yeah. But practically speaking, yeah, just think in terms of getting kalanamitras and start at some point start thinking about finding a private preceptor. So when you're ready for ordination, so which means when you're going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is effective, which means we can see that. Yeah. There's no effective going for refuge if you don't make sure we see it, then it's not effective. Then you get ordained, which means getting ordained on a 4-month course in Guhyaloka, yeah, for almost everybody. I think these courses are really important. It's really important to go on them, if you can. Yeah. I mean, personally, it's just great joy. I mean, it's great fun and very pleasurable. I mean, I just enjoyed them. It's to do with my temperament. But it's great. You've got 4 months, simple life, no distractions. All you have is nature, good company, and Dharma practice. It's all. It's, yeah, nothing else to worry about. You only have to worry, it's enough to worry about, actually, because it's yourself and there's other beings there. Yeah? So there's some people worry, actually, there. Yeah. But on the whole, it's quite a simple life. And you get it. So the importance of this course is you get a taste of the simple life, of the renunciant life. And one aspect of it is you see it's possible. Yeah, so what I noticed, I was on the course last year, is what it's done for me is the simple renunciate life is not just something I read about. I've done it for 4 months. It's a bit sort of uncomfortable, but actually it's possible. I prefer it to be sort of just something other people do in other countries, but actually one can. Yeah. So it gives you a taste of that. It's worthwhile doing. Of course, if you can't go to Guhyaloka for good reasons, you get ordained usually here on a 2-week retreat. We have ordination retreats in autumn here. Yeah. But the attitude is, assume you go to Guhyaloka. Don't enter the ordination process with a fixed idea, I can't go to Guhyaloka. Yeah. I said at the beginning, you don't know what you're going to be doing in 5 years' time. Yeah. And be open that you may be able to make things possible which seem impossible now. Just be open to that. Don't close the Guhyaloka option. Yeah. Just at least stay open to the possibility. And don't close down on that immediately. Yeah. And if there are good reasons for not going, of course you get ordained without going to Guhyaloka. Yeah. And it's a perfectly valid ordination not to be ordained here. Yeah. So that you're less ordained, but you miss out on a certain chance. But it's really useful and important to think, assume you're going to Guhyaloka on a 4-month course, even if you now think it's impossible. Yeah. You don't know what you're able to do in a few years' time. Just stay open to that. Okay, so you ordain. I want to say something about what happens after ordination. Just a few words to warn you. I think before ordination, in a certain way, life is easy. This is horribly romantic, so nostalgic now. But in the ordination process, you've got certain things to do. Yeah, you've got the retreats here to come on. You train. You're in a training. Yeah, you've got extra retreats for men who've asked for ordination. I mean, there's a whole retreat center which is mainly geared up for men who've asked for ordination. So Padmaloka is. I mean, that's the main purpose of its existence. That's what we mainly do. We do other retreats, but that's our core purpose. Yeah. You've got a whole retreat center built for you for ordination process. Interesting to think about, actually. That's what we are for. Yeah. And you've got a fairly well laid out training. Yeah. You've got certain retreats you're doing, 10 pillars, what is the order, going for refuge, transcendental principle. So if you know what you do. Yeah. And also, you know who you are, because you're sort of, well, you know yourself. At ordination, there's also, you can get the attitude that now I have to work hard to get ordained. And then when I'm ordained, everything is fine. It's not going to be like that. And probably the more excited you get about getting ordained, the worse the disappointment may be, because you've grasped that ordination. I mean, basically, after ordination, life continues with all its problems. And some people find their first year out of after ordination difficult. I mean, this happens. Yeah. So forget about the idea, now I have to work hard to get the reward ordination in the end and life will be great. I mean, yeah, ordinations are very joyful, but they're not the end of your problems. They add more problems to your life, actually. And what can happen is you don't know who you are. You're sort of not a mitra anymore. You're just being ordained. You're sort of, I think in the first year after ordination, people can sort of swim a bit, sort of aimless around, don't quite know what they're doing, yeah? So you may have the idea, after ordination, I love teaching the Dharma. But then you get ordained, come back to your center, and all the courses are done by other people. And there's no, and they don't give you a study group. Yeah? So then you have to sort of reduced to that. Yeah. And this is a and also there's no fixed clear training anymore. You have a bit sort of, one can get a bit sort of swimming after ordination, so a bit sort of rudderless. Yeah. So the main point is, it may be perfectly okay. It may be that you enjoy your ordination process, you've got a great course in Guhyaloka, and a great time after ordination. Yeah. It's possible. I mean, that happens often enough. I mean, there are people who work like that. But it could also happen, you struggle to get ordained, you get ordained, and you struggle afterwards. The struggle continues. So don't expect too much in terms of eternal happiness and fulfillment from being ordained. I mean, it sounds bizarre, but I think we can have this attitude very easily. Yeah. So don't, and sometimes these problems after ordination have to do with things you haven't sorted out before. Yeah. So it could be that before ordination, because you want ordination, you do all the right things, all what I've talked about, yeah, but you wasn't really into it. Then after ordination, all that comes out, and you crash. Yeah. So better sort it out before. Yeah. Don't just sort of put on a show of being a Buddhist, sneak your way into ordination, and then fall apart or go away. Yeah. Make sure you sort things out before you go then. It makes life easier. In a sense, the longer the process, the easier it gets to enter the order, sort of with the final touch. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's quite important because that influence to be aware of that life continues. There's a life after ordination with all its problems. Yeah. Be aware of that as you pursue ordination. Yeah. Don't expect a pure land after ordination. Okay, I think this is all about the ordination process. I hope that was helpful in terms of getting to know an idea of what you have to do to get ordained, and also in terms of principles of practice. Okay. Thank you.